Hello, and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
I'm the second host, Aaron Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. The world is getting bleaker and bleaker, so the least we can do is gather and try to make sense of it in these terrible times and maybe even have a little bit of a laugh, because laughter does help. And this week, we have someone very helpful toward that goal of James Adomian. He is a comedian, someone who's made me laugh for a very long time, and for a little bit of levity in these dark times and in these grim times. We're going to speak to him about his comedy and hear some really funny impressions.
Yeah, and make sure you check out his special, Path of Most Resistance. This week, we also have a very exciting announcement, which is that we have an extra interview with Mamadou Tal. He's from the UK, but he's a PhD student at Cornell University in Africana Studies. And he is facing deportation threats over his activism on Palestine. That's right. Cornell University is trying to deport him back to England because of his speaking out on Palestine.
And stay tuned to our channel. We'll be dropping that extra interview very shortly. Because we are doing a more lighthearted interview this week, we are going to jam-pack the four basic food groups with tons of political content to catch you up on all of the horrors in the news. Let's start with the Middle East, where Joe Biden, after bragging a week after Israel began attacking Gaza last October, if you recall this interview with CBS News, Joe Biden bragged that, of course, the U.S. can fuel two wars at the same time. He said, we're the United States, for God's sakes. Okay, of course we can fuel two regional wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Well, Joe Biden is fulfilling the prophecy of God that he invoked and was very proud of, because Israel has now expanded its aggression intensively in Lebanon, carrying out strikes, killing hundreds of people, displacing tens of thousands. And now we're talking more and more about all-out war. And what does Joe Biden have to say about it? Well, he actually thinks it's quite possible.
An all-out war is possible, but I think there's also the opportunity, we're still in play, to have a settlement that could fundamentally change the whole region. Mm-hmm. And I look, one of the things that I found is the Arab world very much wants to have a settlement.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I just want to call him out. I see two flags on his lapel. I see an American flag and Ukrainian. I do not see an Israeli flag. Just got to ding him for that.
He's probably got that tattooed somewhere on his body.
Right. So he doesn't tramp stamp.
Yeah, maybe a tramp stamp. Yeah, Israeli flag tramp stamp.
Because they know what it does for them. Mm-hmm. They're willing to make arrangements with Israel and alliances with Israel if Israel changes some policies. And I've known Bibi Netanyahu for.
If Israel changes some policies, like, what is that vague, ambiguous language referring to? Like, I don't know, if Israel stops committing mass murder and terrorizing not just Gaza, the West Bank, but also Lebanon and Syria, where it's also carrying out regular bombings, like, changes some policies. Like, what is he talking about? He's fueling all this by continuing to arm Israel and veto UN resolutions calling for a ceasefire, covering up the fact that Israel is blocking aid to Gaza. He's talking about, maybe we can have a settlement if Israel changes some policies.
Just make some tweaks.
For a long, long time. And I'm a very strong supporter of Israel. I make no bones about it. Mm-hmm. I said years ago I was a Zionist. All a Zionist means is that there needs to be an Israel. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, though, that Bibi has a picture I signed for him when he was a young member of the embassy here. Mm-hmm. In the United States. And it was 8x10 picture. He asked me to sign. I went, Bibi, I love you, but don't agree with the damn thing you say or do, Joe.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, Joe Biden. Yeah. Many years ago, you signed a picture and wrote that you don't agree with Netanyahu, but you still love him. And your love for him, therefore, is leading you to put aside all your purported, and I would say non-existent, disagreements and continuing to arm him as he sets the world on fire and kills people every single day in mass numbers. And what is he doing to stop it? Nothing. After nearly a year, nothing, absolutely nothing. And he's sitting there, you know, reminiscing about his, like, you know, career in office and talking about what a Zionist he is while people are dying because of him. It's just like, and no one's challenging him on it. This is like the most dangerous person, I think, this is one of the most dangerous people in human history. He's so deluded and yet so simultaneously committed to letting Israel just run wild. And let's finish out this clip.
And I do, and is right, I don't agree with his position. There needs to be a two-state solution. Ultimately, it needs to happen. There's a way.
Okay, so we're still talking about a two-state solution as Israel is committing mass murder and bombarding Lebanon. And of course, while Netanyahu openly says there will not be a two-state solution because Israel reserves the right to steal as much Palestinian land as it wants. So, like, it's such a scary moment. And putting Biden out front, every time he speaks, it's just even scarier because he's completely detached and completely committed to that decades-long Zionism that he loves to brag about.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a compulsion on his part to mention the Zionism. Like, I don't know how many days he can go without bringing it up.
He has all these stock answers that have just been programmed into his brain from years of being a politician. And some of them are, you know, accurate memories, and some of them are fake. You know, like when he talked about going to South Africa and fighting apartheid and
getting arrested.
Yeah. So that's just what he does. He just recycles through the tropes and just talking points that he's had in his brain for years while literally the world is burning around him and he has lit it on fire. And he continues to hand Netanyahu all the weapons he needs to continue carrying out his aggression.
Also, it's so offensive that he's like joking about this, you know, like, I love you, but I disagree with you, but I love you. Well, the things you're claiming to disagree about are like ethnic cleansing. So maybe you should put your foot down on that.
Yeah, and that's the point. He doesn't disagree. And in fact, I would bet, you know, as much as we like to think that he's out to lunch and, you know, he's out of it. I mean, that's true. But also fundamentally, in terms of understanding what Netanyahu is up to, which is Netanyahu's taking this moment right now to make Gaza unlivable and also to punish the people of Lebanon because Hezbollah is in their midst and Hezbollah is the one force in their region that can really resist Israel. I think he's fully committed to that, and he's willing to let Israel slaughter all these people to teach everyone a lesson that they just cannot resist U.S.-Israeli hegemony. And I think he's fully on board with that. And he might play up his, like, you know, elderly, likable, you know, veteran career politician thing, but he knows exactly what he's doing, I think, when it comes down to supporting Israeli aggression. And that's the scariest part of all.
Yeah, I mean, do you think, though, he wants like a slightly less intense ethnic cleansing? Biden?
I don't think he cares. I mean, remember, Blinken went to some of the Arab states, including Egypt and Jordan, and basically asked them, this is early on in Israel's genocide in Gaza, and asked them to basically accept ethnic cleansing, to basically let Israel push out, you know, hundreds of thousands of people from Gaza and have them live in tent camps in the Sinai. And Egypt said no. But that was Blinken being on board with the Netanyahu ethnic cleansing plan.
Right.
And they only weren't able to do it because Egypt said no. Had Egypt said yes, Biden and Blinken, I think, would have gone along with it because they asked for it.
I guess, you know what it is? I think maybe this reminds me of like the Trump phenomenon where the policies maybe not so different. But I think like Biden doesn't want Netanyahu to be so genocidal in his rhetoric, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no. Yeah, they don't like it when Netanyahu openly flaunts the fact that he wants to make Gaza unlivable, or other Israeli ministers say the same thing, or when Netanyahu says there will never be a Palestinian state.
Right, exactly.
Biden knows that there will never be a Palestinian state, but he needs to continue paying lip service to the possibility of one so he can continue arming Netanyahu and letting him commit a mass murder campaign. It's tough. All right, well, but unfortunately, this is not the only regional war that Biden is fueling. There's also Ukraine. And let's check in on how that's doing, because right now Zelensky, as we are recording this, Zelensky is in the U.S. for the UN General Assembly. He does not want to negotiate with Russia because he knows that would entail going back to the Istanbul negotiations of early on in the war, which the U.S. stood in the way of. And Zelensky knows he won't even get as good a deal as Russia offered him back then. So what is Zelensky doing? He's asking Biden, pleading for permission to use U.S. weapons for long-range strikes into Russia, and thinking delusionally that will somehow turn the tide. And now, because of the stakes of this, because Russia has warned of a really harsh response against NATO states if this happens, some of the most devoted proxy warriors on cable news are having some second thoughts. So here, for example, is what happened when Morning Joe, George Scarborough, harsh or a staunch supporter of the Ukraine proxy war, total neocon, interviewed a fellow named Edward Luce of the Financial Times, a liberal guy, but also a staunch supporter of the Ukraine proxy war. And watch this discussion.
They did. I mean, I think we've discovered as this war has gone on that his nuclear red lines are not quite as close as we thought, very understandably, early on in the war.
Exactly, but that does not mean he doesn't have red lines. And this is the mistake, this, if you want to call it the neoconservative, the aging cold warrior wing, that's what we'll call it. But they act as if there is no red line.
There's a reason why Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of Britain, there's a reason why the Polish government, there's a reason why other governments are now saying, look, they're agreeing with Zelensky. Look, let's give him the ability to target sites in Russia that are firing at us. We right. cannot fight. We cannot get anywhere near the position right. where we'd like to negotiate a settlement unless we can strike back on even terms. Somebody used the analogy the other day. I mean, David would know this better. It's like there's all these arrows coming in. Mm-hmm. And you can shoot some of them down, but you're not allowed to target the archer. That is not a fair fight.
Right.
And you know, Biden has said all along, we've two goals here. One is to give Ukraine the means to defend itself, and two, not to start World War III. And it's a difficult furrow to plow in between those two goals, because some of the tools Ukraine needs to defend right. itself might cross Putin's nuclear red line. You're right.
Okay, so you hear that? They are advocating that Biden approve Zelensky's request for long-range strikes into Russia, but he simultaneously, Edward Luce there of the Financial Times, he says, yeah, by the way, some of this might cross Putin's nuclear red line. So yes, what I'm advocating might trigger nuclear war, but that's what I'm advocating, so we should do it, because proxy warriors are so desperate to avoid admitting failure based on their policy of encouraging Ukraine to fight Russia rather than make a peace deal with it. And so this is where we are now. And Biden, who knows what he will decide? I know he's received warnings from the Pentagon that this is not a good idea because it might trigger a Russian response. But again, this is Biden's whole thing. He takes pride in his ability to fuel wars. So who knows what he will decide. But in the meantime, to boost morale for all this, Zelensky went on a tour of Pennsylvania, a swing state, where he stopped by a weapons factory and was joined by the governor, Josh Shapiro, a Democrat. And they decided to do a little autograph session. Let's take a look. There we have it for our audio audience. What we're looking at is Josh Shapiro flanked by Zelensky, and they're signing some bombs, some U.S.-made bombs. And Josh Shapiro is writing a little message, adding a signature. And of course, this is just such beautiful bipartisanship, because we also saw Nikki Haley do this, among other Republicans, for U.S. bombs in Israel. Man. So really, truly, nothing unites us more than our willingness to sign the bombs that we are making to fuel two disastrous regional conflicts, and both parties coming together to do that. But funnily enough, Republicans are not happy about this. They're crying foul because Pennsylvania is a swing state, and they're basically saying that Zelensky, by touring Pennsylvania with Democrats, is trying to campaign essentially for Kamala Harris. And they're saying that this is election interference, which is funny because that's been like the obsession of Democrats ever since 2016, alleged Russian interference. Now, Republicans have actually lodged a complaint and actually asked Zelensky to fire the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine for facilitating this trip. So this has turned into a little controversy. But in terms of actually signing a bomb, Republicans cannot complain, because that's exactly what Nikki Haley and Mike Pence and others did when they visited Israel for bombs made by the U.S. being dropped on Gaza.
I mean, could you make it any clearer that this is a proxy war than by having American politicians sign the bombs?
No, you really can't make it more clear than that, I don't think. I mean, except when U.S. officials say this is a proxy war, right? I mean, right. as many have, although the Biden administration didn't like that when it was said, but many right. people have. But yeah, I think signing the bombs is definitely up there.
Yeah, wow. Well, for Republican suck, let's take a look at Tom Cotton. He was being asked a question about Mark Robinson. Mark Robinson is the Republican lieutenant governor of North Carolina, and he's running for governor, and he's been endorsed by Donald Trump. And he's had some interesting things to say.
When I was watching the Republican National Convention, I heard Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson speak. And Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is your party's nominee for governor in North Carolina, he has been saying anti-Semitic things for years, for years. He said that the movie Black Panther, this is on his own Facebook under his own name, the movie Black Panther, created character created by two Jewish comic book writers, was, quote, created to pull the shekels out of your Schwarze pockets by Jews. And then in the last week, we've heard that he actually was in the past posting on a porn site, calling himself a black Nazi, praising Mein Kampf, saying that Adolf Hitler would have been better than Barack Obama. That is your party's nominee for governor in North Carolina, who has been anti-Semitic for years. Do you like him? You think he should be the next governor of North Carolina?
Look, I've seen these allegations, Jake, and they're concerning allegations. He owes the people of
the
North Carolina.
The shekels thing was under his name on his Facebook page.
He owes the people of North Carolina more answers about it. But we're talking about...
So I guess just to clarify, he's not denying the shekels line that was made on his Facebook page. He's denying that he identifies as a black Nazi on a porn site called Nude Africa.
The presidential race here that matters to everyone, not just the people in one state. Kamala Harris owes the American people a lot more answers. Like, for instance, what she would do about the wars in the Middle East, not just in Gaza, but Hezbollah versus Israel, for that matter, the Iranian-backed terrorists in Yemen that continually target American sailors. Kamala Harris owes a lot of answers to the American people.
Well, that's a good pivot on Tom Cotton's part. And I can't help but think that if a Democrat had said things like, I'm a black Nazi, made a comment about shekels and using a racist Yiddish word, although to be fair, Tom Cotton may not know what that means. I can't help but think that he would be condemning that instead of pivoting to presidential politics and leaving it up to the voters of the state.
I got to say, I got to be contrarian here. I'm sorry. The critique of Black Panther, I will endorse a critique of Black Panther. I mean, not on those grounds, but...
Right.
If you call him Black Panther, I remember going, I was really excited to see it. And then one of the heroes, like the main allies of Black Panther, is a CIA agent.
Right.
I was like, huh? Like, yeah. You know.
And isn't one of the bad guys like anti-colonial?
Yeah, the bad guy, to both of you guys, it was like, was totally anti-colonial. And he's the bad guy. And I remember sitting there like, I was like, I really want to like this movie. It was very well done. But man, I'm sorry, I can't root for the CIA. Especially in a Black Panther movie, when, of course, the actual Black Panther movement were staunch foes of the CIA, and that's why the FBI did all it could to destroy them.
Right.
You know, Mark Robinson, if all these allegations against you are true, and again, you know, we should stress they are allegations, then I don't agree with you on anything, sir. But I will defend anybody who has a criticism of Black Panther. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm still, you know, it's probably one of the last movies I saw in the theater. And I guess I'm just bitter about spending my time in a movie cheering for the CIA.
You're bitter about spending your shekels on it?
Yeah.
I mean, this is interesting. So we could actually invite Mark Robinson on to do a movie review with you, Aaron.
I will. I do not want to sit with Mark Robinson. The allegations of him on that porn site. So the problem is like someone says something that he was this person online. He denies it. CNN hasn't retracted yet. I don't know who's right there, but
right. It
sounds like he definitely has a history of really offensive incendiary statements. So it's quite possible. And yeah. I do not wish to interact with such a person.
Yeah. Okay. So I rescind the invitation. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Mark.
Sorry, Mark Robinson. Yeah.
Well, you know, Tom Cotton did a very good pivot from this story to presidential politics and asking what Kamala Harris would do in the Middle East. So let's take a look at what Trump would do and has done in the Middle East. Here he is speaking at the Israeli-American Council last week.
Just as I promised, I recognize Israel's eternal capital and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem. Jerusalem became the capital. I also recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. You know, Miriam and Sheldon would come into the White House.
This is Miriam and Sheldon Adelson, RIP Sheldon Adelson, a mogul Zionist and someone who's donated a lot to the Republicans.
Probably almost more than anybody outside of people that work there.
By the way, doesn't that kind of look like Trump's wearing a sombrero because of the Jewish star behind him?
It does. Yeah. It does.
And they were always after. And as soon as I'd give them something, always for Israel. As soon as I'd give them something, they'd want something else. I'd say, give me a couple of weeks, will you please? But I gave them the Golan Heights, and they never even asked for it. You know, for 72 years, they've been trying to do the Golan Heights, right? And even Sheldon didn't have the nerve. But I said, you know what? I said to David Friedman, give me a quick lesson, like 5 minutes or less on the Golan Heights. And he did. And I said, let's do it. We got it done in about 15 minutes, right?
I mean, does Trump deliver to his donors or what?
You know, this sounds to me, and maybe I'm just naive here, but this sounds like foreign interference.
Oh, my God.
A president bragging that he violated international law, recognized Israel's theft of the Syrian Golan Heights and moved the embassy to Jerusalem at the behest of two oligarchs working on behalf of a foreign power. That sounds a lot like foreign interference. Where are the Democrats who have spent 8 years hyperventilating about Russian interference and about how Trump was going to do all these things for Russia? Remember, like days before Trump took office, Rachel Maddow delivered this long sermon about how the U.S. has all these troops in Europe surrounding Russia. And then she cited the P-tape, which was just coming out in the media at that time, because the month that Trump was inaugurated, January 2017, that's when the Steele dossier was released by BuzzFeed. So Rachel Maddow said, we now have these allegations that our president-elect is compromised by Russia. What is he going to do with all those troops? Is Putin going to use his leverage to get Trump to withdraw those troops? Okay. And of course, Trump, because there actually is no P-tape and no Russian compromise on him, didn't withdraw those troops. Okay. But now Trump is bragging that he did recognize Israel's theft of the Golan Heights at the behest of pro-Israel oligarchs and at the behest of Israel. And there's no outrage whatsoever. A little bit of a double standard here.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Well, to be fair, he's saying it wasn't even at the behest of them because even Sheldon didn't want it. But sure, he did other things on behalf of Sheldon's lobbying. And obviously, even if he didn't ask for it explicitly, he's doing it to ingratiate himself with Sheldon.
He says, I gave it to them.
Right.
gave the lies to them. It's like this was his gift to his mega donors.
Yeah.
And again, no one cares about this like overt admission of foreign interference and corruption.
Right. Where's either party, right? I mean, both parties will complain about alleged Russian interference. Where's the media that's so obsessed with this? I'm sure they're going to speak out about it, right? Because they really care about this issue in a principled way. It's not because they're like new cold warriors or anything or Russophobes. Yeah, it really is insane.
Oh, man, oh, man.
I know that would be making all the headlines if Trump had said that about like a Russian person as opposed to a pro-Russia person as opposed to a pro-Israel person. Like it would be nonstop. Yeah. Nonstop and calls for, you know, dropping out and everything. All right. So what do we got for Isn't That Weird, Aaron?
For Isn't That Weird, let's turn to the UK, where Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, delivered a saucy call for the release of the hostages taken to Gaza.
Immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The return of the sausages. The hostages.
So if people didn't hear what he just said, he was calling for the return of the sausages, the hostages.
Let's play one more time.
Yeah.
The return of the sausages, the hostages.
There's just something extra funny because he's saying in a British accent.
Yeah.
Sausages.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've cracked up every time I've heard that clip. It's been many times, but it doesn't lose its impact. And so, yes, that's my Isn't That Weird. Keir Starmer mixing up sausages with hostages.
Yeah.
I should say.
Yeah, sausages. Yeah, it happens to everyone, right?
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
For Isn't That Terrible, let's take a look at a little video put out by the atrocious Lincoln Project. They are never Trumper Republicans. And this is a video of Bernie Sanders and Dick Cheney. And the tweet where they released the video reads, Bernie Sanders and Dick Cheney are united on something. That tells us all we need to know. Let's take a look.
Dick, we never got along.
Correct.
You were a warmonger.
And you were a commie.
I mean, can they get a better actor doing Bernie Sanders?
They should have paid James Adomian to do it. I mean, we could
In James Adomian's defense, and James Adomian is our guest this week, and you'll see what a wonderful Bernie Sanders. I mean, this is actually compare and contrast people. You're going to see a master at work shortly when you watch the James Adomian interview. This is just low rent Bernie Sanders. And of course, James Adomian, I would hope, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but I question whether he'd be willing to do an ad for the Lincoln Project. Right. I mean, but hey, it's true that we all need work and, right. you know, but so anyway, I don't want to speak for James, but just compare and contrast everyone. This is like a great way. This is such a bad Bernie Sanders impression.
Yeah, you'll so see. Awful.
Close your eyes when you hear yeah. James Adomian later on. And it's uncanny the way he does yeah. Bernie Sanders.
I mean, so a couple terrible things. We'll go back to watch the rest of it, but just a couple immediate terrible things. It looks nothing like Bernie, and it sounds nothing like Bernie. It also sounds nothing like Cheney. But let's keep watching.
Surprising to be on the same side as you.
Surprising to me, too.
I'm still on the left.
I'm still on the right.
But if we can agree on Trump...
It means something big.
Bigger than policy.
Bigger than ideology.
We are both voting for Kamala Harris.
Because this election is a choice between America...
or Trump.
All right. So, I mean, shout out to them for showing Dick Cheney with a rifle and a bird, because he did, of course, famously shoot his friend in the face while quail hunting. But besides that, I think it's pretty terrible. It's pretty cringe. It's not funny. And it speaks to not something to be celebrated, as we've said before on the show. Maybe it's a bad sign that Dick Cheney is endorsing Kamala Harris.
I'm just getting nostalgic for the 2008 Barack Obama campaign, because although, you know, it turned out to be a complete con, there was a time back then when a lot of us, including myself, could kind of buy into this possible that maybe Barack Obama really represented something different. I mean, after all, the main reason for me thinking that was he did defeat Hillary Clinton
right.
in the primary. And that was very exciting because Clinton right. represented the establishment. And so you could, you know, I wouldn't blame people, including myself, for back then naively thinking that maybe there was some hope with Obama. That's the only time I can remember thinking that actually maybe for once we do really have a genuine, strong difference of candidate here and of policy. In this election, we have now Dick Cheney joining forces with Bernie Sanders, okay, to oppose Trump. And Trump, meanwhile, of course, so many things he says that are just so vile and offensive, demonizing immigrants, bragging, as we just saw before, about how he gave stolen Syrian land to his Israel mega donors because that's what they want. I mean, this is the choice we have. It's just very, very bleak. And certainly ads from the Lincoln Project celebrating how they've managed to unite Dick Cheney with Bernie Sanders just underscores that.
Yeah. And those have been your four basic food groups. Before we get to this week's interview, we are blessed to have someone on this very show who we can interview about his experience on the Piers Morgan show. Aaron, this was your second time on the Piers Morgan show?
Yeah.
That's you. Yeah, that is you.
You know what's funny, Katie, about you saying that we're blessed? It reminds me of when Rachel Maddow was interviewing Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker, when he was pushing that like moronic story about Trump and Russia secretly communicating through a Russian bank server. And Rachel Maddow literally said, I'm not joking, she said, we are blessed as a country to have reporters like Dexter Filkins able to explain these complex stories for us. So we're blessed to have Dexter Filkins push Russiagate propaganda. And we are blessed to use Flatus to have me appearing on with Zionist propagandists on the Piers Morgan show. And it was quite the doozy.
And Piers, you got to have me on.
Well, let's watch a few clips from this for those who missed it. It's not easy to debate Israel apologists. First of all, they interrupt me a lot. It's really hard to get a full answer out because they interrupt constantly. But, well, in this clip, I tried to instruct my two Israel apologist co-panelists, including one of them who's like a Israeli special envoy for something. I'm not sure for what, but anyway, special envoy for Hasbara, propaganda maybe. I try to explain to them a little history that they don't understand. And the reason they don't understand is because they are selling a myth of Israel from its start to justify its ongoing ethnic cleansing and mass murder against Palestinians.
What Israel should do is, for the first time in its history, abandon its quest for regional domination and supremacy. Starting in 1947, just a brief tour through history. Yes, Israel accepted partition publicly. Palestinians didn't. It's not nice to welcome the partition of your land, which is being stolen by foreigners. But privately, Israeli leaders, including David Ben-Gurion, said, we won't accept partition. We'll define for ourselves what our borders are. And that's why they proceeded to expel hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, including into Lebanon, creating this crisis. They refuse to address that. Instead of addressing their expulsion of Palestinians and theft of their land, they've stolen more in 1967. In 1982, the reason Israel invades Lebanon is because the PLO was there, and the PLO at that time was joining the rest of the world in accepting a compromise of a Palestinian state. Google the Arab Peace Initiative. It's been renewed many times to Israel. Israel's been offered by all the Arab states and the PLO, with even Iran joining them and accepting this, everybody recognizing Israel, everybody making peace in exchange for Israel ending its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. That's a major compromise for Palestinians. Israel is so hell-bent on domination, occupation, and supremacy, it's refused even to accept a Palestinian compromise. When Hamas tried to join that after 2005 when Israel withdrew, Israel still put Gaza under a complete siege, prevented any basic goods from getting in, carried out routine massacres. Even when Hamas leaders, including Ismail Haniyeh, who Israel recently killed, said, we will accept a Palestinian state, Israel will not accept it because Israel wants to dominate that region. That's the fundamental problem here. And as it was previously said, as long as Israel insists on supremacy and occupation, people are going to resist it. People will resist it. It's true. Google the Arab Peace Initiative, 2002. Google it.
2000. What happened with the Clinton parameters, 2001?
I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you what happened. The former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was there at Camp David, do you want to know what he said? He was there at Camp David. This is the foreign minister who made the Camp David offer. He said, if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well. You know why? Because he recognizes that Israel insisted on keeping the major West Bank settlement blocks that make a Palestinian state impossible. That's the fundamental problem here. You don't see Palestinians as equal human beings, and you reserve the right to steal their land. And that's why you're interrupting me, because you can't handle the truth. That's the problem here. Stop being a supremacist. Stop stealing land, and you can have peace.
They interrupted me pretty frequently. And for Fleur Hassan, the Israeli special envoy, who said to me on Piers Morgan that Shlomo Ben-Ami never said that, this one's for you. This is Shlomo Ben-Ami saying exactly what I cited him as saying.
Camp David was not the missed opportunity for the Palestinians. And if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well. This is something I put in the book. If I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well.
So there we go. That's exactly what he said. Fleur Hassan said he didn't say that. You can see for himself that he said it. And look, you know, like what to say? She says, you're living in la-la land. Well, she's living on stolen land and has bought into all of these foundational myths to justify that. And I don't know
what
to say.
She's living in both.
She's living in both. Yeah, she's living in la-la. It's true. You're exactly right. To live on stolen land, you actually have to live in la-la land, which is where they are. And I don't know what to say after interacting with members of this cult. How will they be de-radicalized?
That's a good question, yeah.
It's a paramount question because I think the fate of the world kind of hinges on it, because this cult, these people who live in La La Land on stolen land, they have nuclear weapons. And as we're seeing right now, they're a threat to everybody, including themselves. So it's not easy to go up against them because they're just so brainwashed and so deluded. And it's hard to sit there as these people just justify the most inhumane atrocities going on in the world today. And I'm almost perplexed. And it's just, I don't enjoy debating them, but I do think, you know, some people would say, why do you even go on that show? He's just, Piers Morgan is just wants sensationalism, wants conflict. You know, it's a one rare mainstream platform where someone like myself can lay out the facts that I tried to do there when I wasn't being interrupted. And so I think it's worth it for that. But I know some people disagree with that and say it's not even worth it.
I think it's worth it, personally. I mean, you get to correct a lot of misinformation.
When I'm allowed to speak, yes. Here's another clip where Fleur Hassan asked earlier in the debate, where are the Palestinian Mandelas? So this was my response to that.
If you want to talk about Palestinian Mandelas, if you want to talk about Palestinian Mandelas, they exist. For example, in March 2018, thousands of Palestinian Mandelas marched peacefully in Gaza in the Great March of Return, calling for their basic rights. What did Israel do? It gunned them down with snipers, maiming people,
they
paralyzing
were Hamas
them. That's the
terrorists.
Palestinian Mandela. They're people of Gaza.
You see that? So everyone to her who protests for their basic rights is a Hamas terrorist. These are tens of thousands of people, you know, young and old, you know, paramedics, journalists. All of them were gunned down by Israel. You know, thousands maimed and injured, over 200 killed, marching peacefully. So that's the Palestinian Mandela That's one example of a Palestinian Mandela. But in real life, it actually, you know, the better answer would be every single Palestinian is a Mandela, because Mandela in real life, not the sanitized version of him, he supported a people's right to armed resistance against an occupation. So Right. Everybody, every Palestinian who supports armed resistance or just peaceful resistance, no matter what, they're a Mandela, because Mandela actually was principled in supporting the right of a people to resist. So even her, you know, conception of Mandela is completely false.
Well, Aaron, you did a good job, and I appreciate how professional you looked. You had appeared on Pierce before, and you didn't wear a suit, and this time you did wear a suit, and I felt like there was a lot more gravitas.
I didn't have time to put on a suit, because last time, the first time I did Pierce, it was right after we did Monday morning.
Oh.
And I had gotten like the request like right before we started Monday morning, so I didn't have time to change right after we wrapped, so... out of duty to this show.
I was going to say. A lesser man would have bailed on Monday morning, but not you.
No. That's my favorite part of the week.
Do you know what he did have though? All those books behind him showing us how many books he has.
Yeah.
With mass murder and apartheid.
Go back to Canada and your little books behind you. You have nothing to do with this region. You don't speak the languages of this region. You're not.
So yes, that's a few clips from my appearance on the Piers Morgan show. If you want to watch it, go to his channel. You can watch the whole debate. I don't recommend it personally, but I think most people can use their time in a more efficient and productive way. But it's there if you want to watch it on the Piers Morgan YouTube channel.
When Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, he already had 3 missed calls from Chuck Norris.
We all know the man, the myth, and the legend of Chuck Norris. But did you know that in his 80s, he's still alive and kicking butt? Either that or death is too afraid to tell him the news. Chuck wants to share with you what gives him so much energy to work out, stay active, and keep up with his grandkids. He did this just by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s.
And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful.
This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
And we are so excited to be bringing to the show James Adomian, the comedian. You know him from, as he likes to say, 100 cartoons and 1,000 podcasts. And he has a new special out that you got to check out called The Path of Most Resistance. James Adomian, thank you so much for coming.
Hi, Katie. Good to see you.
You too.
It's been a minute.
It has been a minute, yeah. You have a new special, The Path of Most Resistance, which is very funny, which we'll get into. But let's start off by talking a little bit about politics. What are your thoughts on the presidential elections?
I'm looking at it the way I would look at a board game if I was playing it from multiple sides at the same time.
Nice.
I'm looking at it from multiple perspectives. I'll start with the horse race. I think that Kamala Harris is going to do better than people think. I think the swing states are all or mostly going to break in her favor, similar to Obama in 2008. I think a lot of young people are going to be energized, and I just don't think the Republicans are capable of winning a high turnout election. And it's possible, you know, the big cherry on top would be if Ted Cruz loses in Texas. It would be a delicious thing to see. I'm older than I used to be, and so sort of checked out of the hope and possibilities, having lived through Obama and Biden.
Right.
And interestingly, though, on a personal level, I've been, you know, disappointed in Kamala, and I have been won over to the point where I'm actually going to vote for her. And this is a big thing for me, because I've actually never. I was won over. I'm like, I don't always vote for the Democrat in the general election. And, this time I'm going to do it. Wow. And I'm not going to endorse her, but I'm going to make a tactical vote for Kamala Harris, because I think there were some disappointing things, certainly, from the Biden administration. And I have seen, personally, some distance from that, where there's some signals that she's not going to be the same. A big one was the choice of Tim Walz as a vice presidential candidate, which I think was probably the furthest left candidate she could have picked, and also the furthest left and populist and charismatic vice presidential candidate that a Democrat has picked in my whole lifetime. Usually it's always like, oh, the vice presidential candidate is to the right of the presidential candidate who themselves is like a very right-wing Democrat.
Right.
That's usually the formula. Even I would say, even when Obama had Biden, that was a signal that Obama was not going to be that progressive, I think.
Right.
And because, you know, some of us already knew who Biden was, and he was known as the senator representing MBNA in Delaware. And definitely sort of the more conservative Democratic tradition that Biden comes from. And I think I'm not impressed with Biden, and I'm not one of the people that gives him I'm not easily forgiving him for some major failures he's had. But I think that Kamala Harris is a flawed candidate, but from my personal point of view, worth voting for. I say that with reluctance, and possibly could change my mind. You know, there's what, 6 weeks left, something right. like that. I forget how many days are left. You know, I could definitely change my mind on that.
So even though you obviously live in a safe state, right? So why do you say it's a tactical?
I have always, I very freely have voted for third party candidates. And right. I don't, this is something too that I will credit her campaign with, because she is not doing the vote shaming and the left punching that the Clintons did. And I think she made this mistake in 2016 by hiring some Clinton campaign operatives that set up the thing where they were like, okay, we're hired. The first thing we need to do is start fights with Bernie Sanders supporters. Right. And I have, maybe it's just because I'm not on Twitter. Maybe they've done a better job of siloing different types of supporters, but I haven't seen the rabid, insane K-Hive people. And maybe they're not emphasizing them, or maybe they're better with data management, and they're just not showing different people, the different people in their umbrella. Every time I do see someone that's like, you know, a centrist or some kind of like conservative Democrat doing the vote shaming thing, like getting up on a high horse and going like, if you have ever considered voting for a third party candidate or not voting, it's you're to blame. And it's like, no, obviously wrong, but I don't have time to sit here and fight with you. You know, it's right. just like, I'm going to mute or block, and poof, you're back into cyberspace.
Right.
I have not seen them doing as much of that, because I think that, and I do not, on the other hand, I have seen the efforts to keep the Jill Stein off the ballot in certain states, or keep Cornel West off the ballot in certain states. And I'm not sure how much of that is different state Democratic parties and their lawyers versus being coordinated from the top at the presidential ticket level. I do not like that. And I think in a robust society, it would be like an academic debate, where you would obviously have five people in every major television debate. Like, you would, I feel like they're treating me like a child when different political players think that I shouldn't see Cornel West on a debate stage with the Republican and the Democrat. I think if they had the courage of their convictions, they would plan on having a four or five way election every time, and winning on the ideas, and winning against those people, having heard from them. I think that would be a healthier country, a healthier society. And if we were in a college, it would be done that way.
Right.
James, somebody who's like you is excited about Tim Walz is his fellow Minnesotan, Jesse the Body Ventura.
That's a big endorsement when you get Ventura endorsement, because he's like, I don't support the duopoly. There's a duopoly out there. It's like a monopoly, but there's two bankers and they coordinate with each other. I'm not in favor.
Well, if the Kamala Harris campaign, took the leap of like letting people like Jesse Ventura make the case for them if he was a campaign surrogate rather than like Hillary Clinton people. I mean, how do you think he'd be getting out the vote right now for Kamala Harris?
Look, I've been in the ring. I've been an announcer. I have a wrestling history with Kamala from back in the 1980s wrestling days. Now, I understand it's a different figure today. What I'm saying is I'm just asking questions. And could it get any worse? That's the question I'm asking now. She's making some signals. She's making some moves. I think that when you see Trump, you see a fraud on a historic level.
He did endorse Harris and Waltz, and which was a big shock because he I don't think he's ever endorsed a major party candidate. And I mean, that says something. There is something about her that I think there's some distance between. And I hope I'm not just imagining that or falling for something, because that's possible too. And I'm sure many of your viewers will think that. But I'm paying attention and I'm following it as closely as I can. And I'm noting her missteps and I'm noting the things that she does correctly.
It is interesting how the argument seems to be like, this is democracy on the line, so we need to get people off the ballot.
I hate that. And I think it's a weak move, and I think it weakens the country. And it, sure, you might win. We need to get past this thing where you're trying to win, barely win 49% of 50% of the country. Yeah, like these people think it's like normal to have this like razor thin margin when, you know, almost half the country opts out of voting, it's not going to work. That it's a long term structural problem. You've got to get people involved, and you know, unless you want to pull the plug and let everything collapse, and I know some people do. I think you have to respect people. And I deeply disagree with the idea that you're throwing away your vote if you vote third party or choose not to vote. Whenever there's an election, even on statewide or local level, where there's only two candidates and I don't like either one of them, or a judge who's running unopposed or something, I feel free not to vote. It's absolutely perfectly fine to do that. I've done it many times, and this time if the election were today, I'd be voting for Kamala Harris, but there's been other elections where I have not done that. And I'm on the same California ballot. I'm not going to be running for Adam Schiff. I'm not going to be voting for Adam Schiff because I did not like, he's nominally very good for Armenia on the issues, but I really did not like the way he ran his primary campaign and bought ads for the Republicans so that he would have an artificial, we should have had a Democrat versus Democrat general election here. It should have been, Barbara Lee or Katie Porter. It should have been Adam Schiff versus either Katie Porter or Barbara Lee. And I thought it was really like a villain with a mustache and a cape, like that you were going to like run ads for Steve Garvey, the Republican candidate in Bakersfield, so that he would get second place on the ballot, so that you would have an easier time in the general election. Like, that's not what people are donating to you for.
Right.
And I thought that was such a fantastic act of calumny that I was like, nope, no thank you.
James, you were a big Bernie guy. How do you think it is to be Bernie Sanders right now, where, you know, Kamala Harris once endorsed a lot of his policies when she was running against him, like Medicare for All? Now she's like running away from his policies, and Bernie's even playing the part of telling everyone like, yeah, look, she's not as progressive as me. Don't worry, moderates. And, how do you think he's feeling?
Look, there was nobody more disappointed in Bernie Sanders than Bernie Sanders. I've got Bernie Sanders propaganda, the posters, the, you know, the stickers, the bumper stickers. I've got them up all over my house in Burlington, and I look at them and I think, my God, I really sold out. Imagine being a fan of a band and you're in the band too, and you're simultaneously, you gotta go out and do the thing, and you're also disappointed every time you look in the mirror. That's what it's like to be Bernie Sanders these days. Look, we are not in 2016, we are not in 2020, we are further along in the slide towards a catastrophic disaster And in my view, when I say that, that means that's just the way I see them. In my view, that means when I see something, I'm going to say it. In my view, Kamala Harris is the best we got. I'm too old. Let's face it.
You are. It's true.
I am too old. Yeah. And it took me decades to realize that. We are doing the best we can, which in this society, in our current timeline, is not enough. But that's what we're doing.
That's it. That about, that's it. Bernie's, yeah. You know, he's frustrated, but also he's right. He is very old. And when you're old, it's very tiring. It's hard to lead a revolution. And so, you know, he's settled into just getting out the vote for Kamala and hoping that, I think, after she gets elected, she'll take on some of his policies, you know. In Bernie's defense, he did get a seat on the budget committee, you know, from Biden. That was important. And he has
some good at that kind of thing. Yeah. Bernie's, most of Bernie's career has been like achieving things from a place without power, or right, like from a secondary position of power.
Yeah.
Like
the amendment king, right? That's what
the amendment king tacking on some amendment and, you know, getting at least it was watered down, but a partial audit of the Federal Reserve Bank, which would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. He in the fill, when I first really got into, when I first like really grooved with the Bernie Sanders thing, like a fish head finding a he is kind of like, I'm from Vermont. I sometimes riff with the Brattleboro Philharmonic Jam Band. When I first got into Bernie Sanders, it was because of the fantastic filibusters he would do. He would find some bill that was going to pass and like do a multi-day filibuster. And usually a filibuster is done for a very bad reason. For the most part, it's been like right-wing senators that have used it. But he actually did it for left-wing populist socialist goals. And I thought I admired that. And I was like, who is this guy? I want to see more of him.
I want to bring Elon Musk into this chat. And
I appreciate ask
Mr. Musk a question about a recent appearance you made with...
Sure.
The Prime Minister of Italy. Let's go to the picture, Wilson. There you are with Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Now
looking great. Always looking for another mother to a child who maybe accomplishes panspermia on Mars. And when I say panspermia, it usually involves my pansperm.
Now, when she was elected, she was
fantastic, by the way.
She was accused of being a fascist. You know, she had roots in authoritarian movements inside Italy, but you know, all this has seemed to have disappeared recently, and here you are having a, you know, really public confab with her, and there was even talk of some sparks flying. I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on her tenure and fascism in general.
There's the woke, like, referred to as the woke mind virus, and they freely will toss around these racial slurs like fascist against people like me. And I've always said that I was pretty centrist and thought of myself as liberal. And it's not me who, you know, sort of became more conservative. It's Democrats that have left me. And there's some very crude cartoons that have illustrated this point of view that I've reposted as many times. And they'll call you a fascist, you know, like, and it's a terrible, hurtful slur, like cis. And cisgendered. And they'll easily say that to you without looking at a picture like that, which is clear evidence. Obviously, scientific evidence like that, that people that are labeled as fascists and smeared that way are pretty much just like very attractive people that are just simply better than everyone, like living, like you can't, we're drinking wine and smiling and obviously flirting. And I mean, you don't know, but presumably fucking in some penthouse that you don't even have access to. And why is that fascist? That's just better than you.
I want to know what Jordan Peterson's thoughts were on Elon Musk, on the elections, on Meloni.
Well, you know, we've got fellas, you've got to look at it when there's a moderate conservative who comes to power like Meloni in Italy. You've got to get out of bed and make your bed, and you've got to start masturbating about her, because it's the sexual power that we have to make these sex symbols of our right-wing figures. She's your trad wife. you know, she's got to be the standard bearer as the trad wife, the great Statue of Liberty, if you will, but you know, the flame of the of you know, the fasci. And that's what we've got to start masturbating to it and make sure you clean it up, boys. Put it in the toilet, put it in the bin.
Do you want to just give a little bit of a, I wanted to give you the chance because I know you're passionate about this issue. Before we go, anything you want to say about Armenia?
Thank you for asking. You know, I a lot has happened in the last 4 years between Armenia and the ethnic cleansing that happened in Artsakh, which is known internationally as Nagorno-Karabakh. That's the Russian-Turkish name for the region. And it's a region, it's the what is Armenia now and what was recently Artsakh and Nakhichevan are the last corner of what used to be a very large country, pre-Rome, it dates back before the Roman Empire. The Armenians are indigenous to that place, and they're a union of these ancient tribes, the Urartuans and the Mitanni, and a couple of other ancient tribes that formed a confederacy before the time of recorded history. And, you know, they dig up, I'm saying this because the Turks always try to attack the indigenous nature of the Armenians as being false. Every time they dig up ancient bones and skeletons, they do a DNA test on it. The closest relative is the Armenians who live in Armenia today. And not just in Armenia, but in also in what used to be Armenia, in what is today Eastern Turkey. Or Northwest Iran, or Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh. And so it's the people that evolved in this land, you know, from the time before recorded history. And there's this multi-century campaign to remove them. And I'm only a quarter Armenian, but it's something I feel, because I have family that is more Armenian than I am, and I've always followed the history with great admiration and the culture. And what happened to Armenia was devastating and depressing, and it's very difficult to describe, because, you know, a lot of people know some anecdotal Armenia in America or even Europe, you know. Oh, my teacher. Oh, my colleague in college, or, you know. You know, my best friend back at this time in my life or whatever, my neighbor. And people know some of the basics. They know where there was the genocide during the Ottoman Empire that was committed by the Ottoman Turks. And there's a lot more that people don't realize, that it's ongoing. The big problem is, you know, and I could speak about European media and other things, but I'll focus on America in media and politics, is that they have different postures. NPR, for example, has different settings where they're going to be pro, anti, or neutral on something. And all the news networks from right to left had a either neutral or hostile setting against Armenia. In the 2020 war, when Azerbaijan and Turkey ganged up and attacked Artsakh and Armenia, and by the way, is you'll see some news stories where they try to cast it as a tit for tat thing, where it's, oh, Armenia and Azerbaijan. It's like spy versus spy. Azerbaijan outnumbers the population of Armenia by 3-1, more than 3-1. And combined with their close ally, Turkey, they outnumber Armenians more than 30-1, like 33-1. Armenia is vastly outnumbered by an opponent that wants it gone. 3 years later, last fall, there was a 3-year moment where the Russians came in as these like disreputable peacekeepers and were openly favoring. They favored Azerbaijan during the war, before, during the war, and after the war, when they were peacekeepers, and allowed this starvation blockade to happen for almost a full year. And then it ended with the full, complete ethnic cleansing of all 120,000 Armenians from Artsakh. And the news, the line that the Western media took was that, well, it's not ethnic cleansing because they got in their cars and drove away. Right. They also had no outside reporters at all on the ground in Nagorno-Karabakh when the ethnic cleansing happened. Not a single cameraman, reporter, not anyone who wasn't a native Armenian was on the ground filming, reporting anything at all. So there was all these rural villages where they just killed a bunch of people and there's mass graves. And the UN hasn't even sent anyone to investigate if there's mass graves. Azerbaijan sent a fake UN mission from the Baku United Nations office that was like only Azeris and Hungarians. And Hungary, the dictatorship in Hungary is closely aligned with the dictatorship in Turkey and Azerbaijan. And so it's this maddening thing where Armenia has no allies. But in real life, in the arts, Armenians are friends with everybody in America, you know, in sciences, in showbiz, in academic and business worlds.
Math, like your grandfather?
Yes, my grandfather was a well-known mathematician who collaborated around the world with mathematicians, physicists, and scientists who were not Armenian. And he was a beloved figure in the industry, the math industry. That sounds weird. But diplomatically, on a geopolitical level, they have no allies. Russia has been anti-Armenian since the days of Gorbachev. If you want to go real deep, you can look up the Operation Ring. When before the Soviet Union broke up, Gorbachev cooperated with the Azerbaijani Turks to try to destroy Armenia at that point, before the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh broke out. And then going back to the early communist period where Stalin, being from Georgia, had his own, what do you call it?
Axe to grind,
thank you, against the Armenians and chopped up Armenia. Right after the genocide that the Turks committed, the Russians came in and chopped up Armenia a little bit more and killed a few more people and made sure to execute the people who had successfully resisted the final stages of the genocide. So there's this long history of the Russians and Turks coming in and doing a dance with each other where they take turns beating up the Armenians. And the British, and you would think, oh, okay, well, if one side hates Armenia and supports Azerbaijan and Turkey, well, then the other side will swoop in and play the opposite side. No! NATO is also very pro-Turkish, very pro-Azerbaijan. And it's like one of these crazy things where both sides are opposed to Armenia existing as a country. The Heritage Foundation, the right-wing think tank, is very, very anti-Armenian. Hmm. And no one has reported on it during the Project 2025 stuff, which put them in the news. The Heritage Foundation is in D.C. It's a right-wing conservative think tank that's very, very anti-Armenian, very pro-Turkish and pro-Azerbaijan because they're funded by oil pipelines and so forth. The BBC is even more than American media. The BBC actually actively hates Armenia, and they have presenters on BBC television that openly called for the ethnic cleansing of Artsakh and said it was a good thing when it happened and said that it was inevitable. And the BBC hates Armenia. And that's because BP is a major partner in the pipeline between Baku and Ceyhan in Turkey. It's the Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan pipeline, the BTC pipeline. And it's been under construction for 20 years, and it's been open recently the last few years. And it's a very lucrative thing for British Petroleum and Chevron. And I believe Gazprom is also a partner. And if it's not a partner in that, it's a partner in the other pipelines in the region. And Rush, there's this charade that people play where there's sanctions against Russia. Russia evades the sanctions on gas by piping their gas to Azerbaijan, and then it's put in the pipes to the West. And that's like a crucial thing for all these politicians to uphold, is this absurd it's like gas laundering of this.
And the West pays more money for it because they're getting it through such a circuitous route.
Yes.
Rather than get it directly from Russia. So it's a scam for everybody.
They celebrate Aliyev, the dictator of Azerbaijan, the hereditary dictatorship of Azerbaijan. His father was a KGB strongman in Azerbaijan, and he has inherited the dictatorship. And he gets lauded by these NATO-oriented think tanks and these anti-Russian think tanks. And it's like, this is a KGB family. And Erdogan, a bloodthirsty dictator, really, and the people aligned with him celebrate not only the ethnic cleansing of the Armenians in Artsakh, but in 1915 to 1923, all over what was Western Armenia. They celebrate the ethnic cleansing of the Greeks in the coastal cities of Asia Minor that happened also in the early 20th century. They celebrate the simultaneous genocides against the Assyrians and the Lebanese and other minority groups at the same time.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
And again, James's special is called Path of Most Resistance. We will link to it. It's very funny. James, as we saw, is hilarious, very talented. Great to talk to him.
Yes. And don't forget, we have an extra interview this week with Mamadou Tal, who is a PhD student at Cornell facing deportation charges over his activism on Palestine.
And go to usefulidiotspodcast.com to support the show and get bonus content, including something we didn't have time for today, but it's in this week's Thursday Throwdown. Antony Blinken being caught falsely telling Congress that Israel was not blocking humanitarian aid, even though two U.S. agencies told them that that's exactly what Israel was doing. And when Blinken went on TV this week to get interviewed about it, the U.S. media did him a great service by helping him cover it all up. So that's in this week's Thursday Throwdown, which you can get at usefulidiotspodcast.com.
As always, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next week. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.